You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. On the program tonight, we have Mr. Bill Pressey IV. Welcome, Bill. Good to see you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Bill, first of all, having lived in New York, I know a bunch of juniors, you know, mostly from Staten Island. I know several guys who are the third, mostly from Connecticut. You're the first fourth I've had the pleasure of meeting, so... There's a first. Bill is the inventor and founder and co-owner of Lab Golf. What we'll try to do this next 30, 45 minutes is try to get to know the man, Bill Pressey, and the company Lab Golf, and maybe talk a little bit about what it takes for a new golf equipment company to get some love from the men and women who play tournament golf for a living. And maybe we'll start there. We had Sam Hahn on, your business partner, the Monday after Charles Howell won on the LIV Tour. And ironically, you're on the Monday after Richard Bland wins a major on the Senior Tour. I'd like to think we have something to do with that. But the question is this, how do you watch these things? Do you jump around in front of the TV? And I mean, how excited do you get?
Well, the first win on the PGA Tour we got, I was watching that with my buddy Jordan in his garage, which was fun to celebrate with a friend. And then... you know, the other ones, it just sometimes you never know where you're at. But this morning, because here it concluded Monday morning, I was a little excited before noon to get a senior U.S. Open with one of the putters I designed. Was pretty surreal this morning. So, it's pretty exciting.
What does it mean to you as an inventor?
It's the ultimate kind of gift, you know, beyond the financial successes of being, you know, selling and monetizing an invention. Any inventor always wants to see their invention win bigger things, more important things than money, which is titles and maybe even help. In other circumstances, get somebody somewhere or whatever. But getting a senior U.S. Open was, I'm just shocked still this morning.
Yeah. That's 2-1 now with your stick, right?
Yes. Yeah. Richard is, just a phenomenal player. And we don't really appreciate, you know, what playing against younger guys can do to the older guys and keep them pretty sharp. So regardless of the putter, it's amazing to watch his play consistently in majors. And he won his first major on the senior the PGA Senior Championship. And then that was a Lab Mez. Or Mez Max, maybe a Mez Max. And then now with the DF, which is with the USGA is listed as the Directed Force Reno, is the model. But we've kind of just come to call it the Directed Force now because of the rebranding with Sam into Lab. So it's been good.
Right. Well, I found a review of the Directed Force from 2016. So we'll talk about that. When Sam was on, I think I introduced him as the Carsten Solheim of the 21st century. He very quickly turned the spotlight on you that you were behind that. that putter, not him. And today I found out how unprepared that statement really was, because I found some of your business cards from 2014 and some of the heads of those first putters. And on it was printed "the most innovative putter since 1750, way ahead of Mr. Solheim's time. I'm familiar with 1744 and the first rules of golf. What happened in 1750?
So when, you know, once I came up with the invention and the design and, you know, years in the club business, I've seen most designs. And so I knew that I was going to do something much different and kind of blaze my own trail, because I had my own technology and press grips and lab balancing. And I said, well, you know, want to make a design that's unlike others as well. So that was really the kind of the, you know, that's where we want to go.
Right. But 1750, nothing special happened.
Well, so that's right. So in the books, like if you go in the history books, and you start looking at the names of golf clubs and the purposes, and we've got our Masheys and Niblicks and mid irons and Brassies and Spoons, and so when you go back prior to 1750 in my research, which may not be perfect, but I could only find putting clique or different names. And it was right around 1750 was the first time I could find in print the word putter.
Hmm.
And prior to that, it was called putting clique, or it'd be like an 11 iron or other names.
Yeah.
So that's why I said 1750 is the first time we really got the word putter that we can use and say, this is a putter. And it's never changed since. So prior to that, we had these other names.
That's a pretty cocky statement.
Oh, it raised some eyebrows, that's for sure. But this goes along with the shape. I mean, you might as well just go all the way if you're going to go.
Yeah, a little. But, you know, at the very beginning, and I wouldn't call myself a history buff. I enjoy reading about it. You know, the first golf professionals and the guys that were winning the tournaments, they were, most of them were also club makers who made their own clubs. And you were a player. You're a PGA pro, and you played on the mini tours, and
I would play in some mini tour events, and I get, you know, out of high school, took a couple years off, and then went to Scottsdale, and then played. I went to the San Diego Golf Academy in 1994 through 1996. We were the first graduating class out of the Chandler, Arizona campus. It was still SDGA. And then we started playing on the Western states and money, little money games and anything we could really get in the Phoenix Basin. You know, all sorts of games. So you make your living off playing, you know, games around the neighborhood. And you know, back then in my 20s, you know, we were having so much fun being a golf pro and trying to win some money on the weekends and get rent paid for the month.
Right.
And then
right
back in the good old days. So, I just never got good enough to play on the PGA Tour or, you know, make a really good living or make a firm living at it. And I made some poor life choices, as youngsters do, that you recover from. And so looking back, you know, you want to make different decisions, but I don't know if I would now.
Right. Some old folks make bad decisions too. I mean, I know plenty of them. Mm-hmm. Did the, Did the idea of inventing a putter come out of a necessity, you becoming a better putter? Did that have anything?
Yeah, so that's an interesting story. That, you know, the whole lab, Directed Force Foundation, lies in three putting on a Monday qualifier, in front of Patty Sheehan, standing on a hill at Hidden Valley Country Club, and I'll never forget it. Like, you know, I'm hitting greens like there's no tomorrow. And I think I hit 16 greens, I think. I shot 72 on a Monday, on a really tough course. And I just couldn't believe how poorly I putted. But it was the sixth hole or fifth hole at Hidden Valley, a par three, 220. And I hit the center of the green and then three putted from 30 feet. And Patty Sheehan was standing on the hill, and she's a member at the club. And I looked up. I'm like, oh, I just can't believe that. And so I got home that night, and, you know, having a few beers and being in July or whatever it was, August, it was just hot. It was hot and sweaty, and I had suntan lotion on, and I'm grinding over my putting stroke that night. And I have at the time I had a Ping CU5, which is a long net manganese bronze face balance putter that I had from the works department, made for me with a machine line in it. And I had that in a Cobra tricep lock position. And so I extended the shaft and I leaned it forward. And so when I got home, I cut the grip off to, you know, really kind of feel the shaft. But in that position, when you're in an outside tricep lock position, you can hold the shaft on the lie angle and kind of press it on your arm, but you don't need very much grip pressure. And ironically, my hands were so greasy from sweat and suntan lotion, and, you know, I couldn't keep the face square. It was literally, it was like having a ball bearing on the shaft. And I kept swinging it. I'm like, that's, when I go forward, it's not staying square. It's not even trying to square up. And I'm noticing this. And so then I take, I kind of like, then I get some real grease, and I really grease the shaft where I put my hands, and I'm holding it, and my shirt is so slippery that the steel shaft extension, there was no, you know, friction, really, very little. And it all allowed the physics to kind of reveal themselves to me. And when they revealed, when that happened and it revealed what was going on with face balance, I immediately grabbed a toe hang putter, which is supposed to flow, rammed an extension in the end of it, greased it up with my hands again, and it went opposite. And I'm like, no way. This is crazy. I thought I was like on drugs. Like, well, I may have been on drugs, but I thought I was really out of my mind, because everything I knew as a golf professional was just being rocked. You can't, as a visual person, a visual learner, especially me, you can't unsee it. You can't. And so there's this battle in your head that says everything I've been taught is that a face balance putter stays square. It's not happening. What am I doing? What's going on? Anyway, so that night after the Monday and putting so terribly poor and playing so well tee to green, I invented lab. I mean, I discovered it. And then by the morning, I had a lab putter.
This is the what you just described with, you know, the putter grip feeling like a ball, it has a ball bearing on it. That was the birth of the revealer.
Yeah, and that's where, well, it's a process. So I so at that time I said, well, I want to keep the face square. And the very first putter, lab putter, was balanced with a bunch of forward shaft lean, like 10 degrees. And it was awesome, like, right? But I was using it in a tricep lock position, almost like Bryson is now. But imagine Bryson's shaft, instead of going inside his forearm, it goes inside his hand, over his left forearm, and then pinches on the outside of the left shoulder, right? Do a real up like this.
Yeah.
And then so the shaft was in the back, but then the USGA banned anchoring. And so I couldn't lean it and do all that. So I redesigned the grip and then moved the shaft to a location that would be balanced in the short putter position without all the forward lean. And then it was a home run. And then, but that happened over like a couple of weeks. But once the USGA banned the rule, it was like the next morning I had lab figured out. And then like a couple of days later, I had press grips figured out. It's kind of all a blur. When I think about stuff, you know, it all happened. And at the time I was drinking for quite a bit. And not like raging alcoholic. I was just a regular guy that would drink beer and, you know, have one or two at night or whatever. We were the boys golfing. And so, you know, it's so long ago, but I remember it like, you know, pieces but the actual, everything that is lab now, everything that we see from the press grips, the revealers, the way shaft lean works, and the remote fitting, which we utilize on the website. Gosh, I don't know what else.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it all came about pretty quickly, and it was all happening as the USGA changed the rules. So at the time, I was a director of instruction at Golf Tech, you know, teaching untold amount of lessons.
That must be worse than free putting on a Monday.
Yeah, and then scrambling at the same time, you know, to get this putter company, get this idea, because I saw it in my head. Mm-hmm. But then they kept changing the rules on the fly. It was like I was going through this process, right as I was going through this process. But it all worked out, and I just, you know, I'm so thankful that the USGA changed the rules so that belly putters and anchoring, because those are all effective levers to fight torque. And I think the USGA knew this. Mm-hmm. At some level, when we're playing hockey, you know, it's one thing to be a goalie or something like that, but I think the basic fundamentals of the game is that we have two hands, and you know, they need to be attached to the golf club, and other parts of the golf club, touching other parts of the body besides your hands. I don't think that is a way the game was designed. Those are, in my opinion, those are crutches.
Right.
And I say that tenderly because we do sell arm lock putters, right? And I know it helps a lot of people. But I'm a purist of the rules, and I'm the first one to be my own critic. Uh-huh. So I invented press grips in the whole system so that forevermore they can't ban it.
Right.
Because it's what we already do. But now we have a putter that stays square. And ultimately I missed putts on that Monday because of the yips. I would get in close. I'd relax my hands and my face balance putter was putting torque on my hands. And then my forearms start responding to my eyes kind of picking up on my face being open, you know, and after a while, you know, your athleticism, your desire to win will start making adjustments to make anything work. And then that's when you start going down the rabbit hole. So once I had the concept of lab and lingual balancing, and the rules were done and that was done and dusted, and we could move forward as the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Then I took the revealer and all the short parts and really got it going into something much more polished and refined, and designs. You know, there's several putters before the direct force that you see on the market, the Reno.
When was this? Bill, what year was this? About?
That was like two. Well, the whole thing started, I think, in 2011, 2010, and then kind of fired up the company in 2012. So it's been almost 12 years.
It's been out there for a long time.
And yeah, yeah. Well, original company was Directed Force Putters.
Right.
And then we had some really good exposure. I had Bryson when he first turned pro. He was using my putter. And then we had Jeff Sluman.
Uh-huh.
Charging into the lead of the British Senior British Open years ago,
yeah,
with a blue directed force, and then Adam Scott, and then you know, all these little things. Alfonso Ribeiro, like waving his putter around at the celebrity. You know, I kept getting all these little breaks, and then you know, more orders would come in to stay alive, and then you know, we were cruising right along. So, yeah, it led into partnering up with Sam and. And then we formed Lab together. So it's been good.
But I mean, this, and maybe try to explain it to the layman, to the average guy, the face balance versus the lie angle balanced, which is what Lab stands for. The way you describe it, I wonder why anybody would still be playing a face angle putter.
I don't know. I mean, it's because we've been classically conditioned by the big OEMs under this false physics. It was a marketing war. And I'll tell you how. You want to know how it started, Frank?
Yeah.
Back in the 80s, Ram came out with the Zebra.
Right.
And Ray Floyd was killing everybody with it. And it said face balanced on the bottom.
And yeah, they, I had one of those, one of my favorite putters.
Right. And then what happened was, at the time, if you go right there, and if you're a history buff, this would be really funny for you to check. Go back to the date when Ray Floyd came out and look at any old Golf Digest marketing for ping.
Uh-huh.
There's no such word as toe flow. Didn't exist. That was not part of the physics of the stuff behind the answer, the plumber's neck. And so they were losing market share to this new thing called face balance. And so their marketing, as far as I can tell, shortly after that is when you see heel toe weighting kind of takes a back seat, and the buzzword becomes toe flow.
Right.
And that was to counter face balancing. Mm-hmm. And because the Zebra showed us this demonstration on a table by somebody with credentials and respect and credibility to sell putters, then we say, well, because the putter's balanced to the sky, it's perfectly balanced. And somehow we were led to believe that when we put it in a different dimension, which is a golf dimension, which is lie angle, which is not the same as on a table, the physics change. So if the physics apply to the face being square to the sky on a table, but then you tilt it down in a golf position, they can no longer be the same.
Right.
So you can't, how we got baffled and blindfolded and befuzzled for years between marketing firms,
mm-hmm.
And then it became It's this old golden rule. After so many generations, it becomes fact.
Right.
This happens in history.
Yep.
And this will happen in any time you want to change history. And so it's really, as a golf professional, I started in the business in, I think I gave my first lesson in 86, maybe, in high school, literally.
Yeah.
Make some money. But I was building clubs, you know, since the 84 and tinkering. And so I just met, we just wonder how we got there. So when I created Lab, I damn well knew that I was going to be on the cross, if right. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
And a target. So I came in with the revealer saying, okay, beat this. This is my machine gun, right? This is what, as fast as you can throw objections up, this thing will knock it down. Yeah. And if you can't see it visually, sorry to say, but we're just not sure if the earth is round or not, right? You know, like, come on.
You're fighting Madison Avenue.
Yeah. So, but that's really, the whole process and launching something that is a disruptor in such a large industry is terrifying. I mean, my professional career that I'd worked pretty hard to get to where I was, which I thought, you know, was doing good things, you know, and I was. But to give that up was terrifying, especially being a father, a widowed father, you know, just raising my daughter is brutal. Like, it was mentally terrifying. But at the same time, I believed in it so much. I'm like, I cannot not do this. Like, right. I've got to go all in.
And you knew they were going to put you on the cross.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, just kept getting all these little breaks over the years. And then when Sam and I formed Lab, it was, we're able to, you know, inject some capital and get some real marketing firm and marketing dollars and build a new factory up in Reno, which was bigger than the original factory in Carson, which is about the size of a small corner of our new factory. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really been one heck of a journey.
Let's talk about Lab now and the future of Lab in a bit. But the way I try to understand it, this phase balance versus lie angle balance sounds to me like it's as big as persimmon to metal woods.
I think a lot of people, especially old timers and traditionalists, can compare it like that. I hear that often.
Wow.
There's not much difference. I mean, for an analogy, when we would talk about off-center impact, which was really the biggest game with metal, right? Is the off-center impacts, and you know, for a long time, center for center, and still today, if you hit a titanium metal head in the screws, and it's the same length driver, and it's same length, same weight, same loft as a persimmon, they go the same distance. I mean, within a yard or two.
Yeah.
MOI is MOI. So it relates to, we would take and use heel toe weighting to change the sweet spot size or make the sweet spot size bigger. This is relative to a putter in woods. By making them hollow, you're making them heel toe weighted and top line and sole. And so in the dimensions of making a club forgiving, there's different dimensions. You've got length, loft. Those are factors of forgivingness. You've got also, you know, head shape, head size. So these are all options to make a club forgiving. And in a metal wood, when we went from persimmon to a tailor-made burner, It wasn't a big game, right? It was just like, wait, we didn't have to worry about these metal woods being in our bag without our head covers and, you know,
We still
whatever.
call them woods.
Yeah, we still call them woods. There was always that battle. He was like, oh, forever. It was so hard. And this is somebody, you know, you had people saying they're metal woods. And we're like, ah, whatever, man, they're woods. Just get over it. I remember that thought. It was yesterday. It was so funny. Yeah, and so with Lab, now in the revealer, once I had everything together, I discovered that if I hit a ball off the toe, I mean, just stupid off the toe, like an inch and a half, an inch off, you know, nobody hits impacts out there, maybe, but. And in the revealer, there's no resistance. I mean, it's so minuscule. And the ball is on and off the face, on its line, the same line as it was on when the face and the ball made impact as soon as they touched. And so what I discovered in this process of discovery is that heel toe weighting doesn't make a ball go any straighter. It's zero effect. In fact, it's absolute zero effect. What it does mainly is maybe get the ball to go a little farther on off-center hits, right? Outside that, when we come into a golf ball with a putter traveling at whatever, 2 miles an hour, 3 miles an hour, doesn't matter. The ball is on and off the face before that mass can actually change angle. You're talking, if you clock a putter off a putter face, it's like a quarter of a second.
Right.
This mass would have to be going at such a physical rate before impact to change in a quarter of a second. That many degrees, or 2 degrees, or 1 degree. It physically can't happen. So when we get outside all the marketing bullshit, and we start looking at physics and laws, this stuff is impossible. So what Lab, when I created Lab, I realized that it doesn't take anything but MOI in a balanced position to make the entire face without any outside manipulation or holding or squeezing, is that the ball will always leave on the same line, but the distance control is much greater than with a putter that makes impact that is already torquing. It's just the craziest thing. You see demonstrations I've done on YouTube, like directed force putters, heel toe strikes on YouTube. Or you put in my name on YouTube and directed force heel toe strikes, and you see it. And he's when millions of people, you know, when 10,000 people see it, it doesn't change the industry.
Yeah.
When 20,000 people see it, when 100,000 people see it, it still doesn't change the industry. But when 1 million people see it, now you can't hide from it.
Yeah.
And so in casual conversations like we would be having on the back patio of a golf course, these things come up between gentlemen in conversation.
Yeah, they do.
And that is where I think the success of Lab, so much of it comes from, is these guys, gals, juniors talking about Lab on the back porch.
Right.
You know, or in the golf cart, or, you know, at the restaurant or whatever. So it's really been we made it past the first 3 years, which was, I was super proud after surviving my first 3 years in business and still having money in the bank and paying my workers, right? You know, it was good. And we had a little sales rep system. And then, you know, 5 years came around and, you know, and I hit some turmoil with some of the a minor investor in the company. I can't really talk about it, but and then Sam bought a putter And then the head came off and he called me for some customer service and took care of him. And we started, you know, him and Han together on social. And then a couple of weeks later, he sent me a message asking if I was interested in, you know, buying the company and starting Lab and or a company together. So yeah, it worked out. It worked out really good. And he came in and bought out all the initial other owners. And then him and I took my same shares and equity from the original company into Lab, and we started Lab. So,
just to, if we rewind 90 seconds or so, I'll never forget the day Bill Pressey called me an old timer. Thank you for that. But and
I
with
call.
That, yeah. Oh, it's a compliment.
I call people all the time.
Compliment. without getting too technical, the patents that you own that cover this lie angle balanced putter. Is it the whole shebang?
Yeah.
Yeah. It is.
It is.
It is.
It's really hard. It's really hard to get. And because, I mean, I spent more than 6 months pretty much every night after teaching, researching old patents, going back in history as far back. And I don't know how many other patents I cited in my patents, but there's patents cited within those patents, which within those patents, it goes way back. So nobody had ever done this in the history of the U.S. patent office and in golf. So I was very lucky and very blessed to stumble upon this and then have the capability and the experience and years of experience in the business to understood what I was just seeing and to understand that that is not, well, this is an opportunity if I can fix it. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, discovery is a big process, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to save it for later, but you know, when you think about inventing stuff and being an innovator, I mean, obviously it's creativity and to me always, having five children, I know that the one thing that feeds creativity the most is curiosity, but that alone isn't enough. I mean, we all have great ideas at some point in our lives. I mean, I remember I had an idea when the pay-per-view started. I said, "Come on, let's do a paper listen. We'll have Howard Stern, you know, commentate the Super Bowl or something like that, you know." And then I don't know, 15 years later, what's his name? The Canadian comic who just died, Norm Macdonald. He was doing master's commentary on YouTube. That was hilarious. Anyway, we all have these ideas that then somebody else does them later on. So, you know, we have these pictures of inventors as a dropout geniuses that just have an idea and somebody else does it. But there's more to it. And I think with your story about the patents, you just proved it, because it's not just creativity. It's the development and the production and the implementation of the idea that really makes an inventor an inventor, correct?
Yeah, the idea part is the easy part. The monetization, let's cut to it. It's monetization is the hard part, and there's no path. When you go to college, there's no classes.
Right.
That they teach you how to monetize your inventions. Or there's no degrees in that. And when you get into the unknowns in this world, what people do for a living, you know, a lot of people have a lot of odd jobs and make a living in a lot of ways that are not in college, right? These are way off the beaten path. And it's entrepreneurship. But yeah, for going through the USGA, I think I've got six conforming products, letters, rulings from the USGA, six or seven, pending IP. And then, you know, I think I have two issued patents, three issued patents. So yeah, it's good.
How does and in the last, you know, since that first, in the last, let's say, 12, 18 months, this really took off, at least on my watch sitting here in Germany.
Yeah.
People started talking about it, and you know, you would look for players on TV. Whoa, is that a lab? You know, which you really don't do with any other play, with any other club, when you watch a tournament on TV. Were you guys surprised when it happened, or how quickly it happened, and how do you, how did you, or how are you ramping up your production to meet the demand that's out there globally now? I bet.
Well, you know, I think you're referring to Lucas Glover and his back-to-back wins, one being in the FedEx Cup win.
Right.
That was in such grand fashion, it's hard to explain. I mean, just the whole story behind it is it led to there's so much into it. But Glover was playing so hot the 3-4 weeks before, and everybody could see it out of nowhere, from basically almost being on Corn Ferry, you know, partially, to his name being on the, you know, top 10 and, you know, top 15 or top 5, the weeks leading up to it. You knew it, like I could feel it. But I didn't, I can't sit here and say, oh yeah, I called it, you know, like, you know, yeah. I didn't, you know, you're watching it going, is this going to happen? Really? Is this going to happen? And it did. Like, you're like, whoa. And of course, with a broomstick, which yeah. was fine because, you know, we broke all records in broomstick sales in the history of golf. I promise you, there's yeah. nothing even close. And that's when things started to ramp up. And we had had a very good year on the year prior. And through wise choices and marketing and growing the company, we're prepared to, kind of try to keep up with the initial demand. But, I mean, it's just, like you remember the story behind Seymour, when the response, when Clay Long designed that response and Jack won with the response. And it was one of those things, but on a bigger scale. And you know, because more people see what they're using now than they did then. And it just lit it up. And then we ramped up factory, and I there's days that we would sell more putters now than I would my first year, but they're big days. I mean, it's a lot of putters.
Yeah.
and outside, like, you know, like the growth of the company right now is so confidential.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot at stake, and when we're making an impact on the bigger OEMs, it's best not to let them know.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. I'm not trying to. when are you going public? This is really my question. I'm just talking about how prepared were you to produce that many putters from a physical standpoint, you know, to have the raw materials and the people and the logistics behind it and that kind of stuff. I mean, you don't do that overnight if you're not prepared.
No, we had been quietly growing in the background and our capabilities to produce and ship that many putters a day and have the sales funnel, you know, where you got our wholesale funnel and our retail funnel, mm-hmm. direct to consumer, mm-hmm. wholesale,
mm-hmm.
and having those kind of come into the same system,
mm-hmm.
and then making sure that the build sheets and every putter that's being made right and efficiently, and all these build stations, so every putter is handmade and balanced, and uh-huh. I mean, it's quite a production, and the biggest art. the biggest lesson I had to learn was how to scale something. And my original business partner, Scott Soprizio, he said, it doesn't matter if you can make it one time, it's worthless. You got to reproduce it.
Yeah.
And so, and when I created Lab, because I was already with Scott on, you know, the press, the billboard grip, Scott took lessons from me. And he also had a patent for a baseball glove that he did years ago. So I taught him golf and I, you know, showed him the stuff I was doing and we became business partners. And that was my first partner anyway. So, I forgot what I was saying. The
ramping up.
Yeah. The ramping up and the scalability, because he is in the piston company. He owns a piston company. That makes race pistons and Silverlight and pistons for Ford and Chevy. So they make a lot of pistons. And the conceptualizing from being a golf pro and how to make a golf company is all about scalable. Uh-huh. This is, you know, you got to make this repeatable. This is a burger. Now, if you want to add an option of no pickles, and then you've got to add something in the whole system for that customer to say, no pickles.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Or extra lettuce. Or,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like, this is the basics of McDonald's.
Right. It is.
It is. And so that's what I had to learn and create and come up with. Because, yeah. I mean, going through the PGA, and I didn't go through the whole PGA. I've been in the PGA program twice. So, hey, two-time PAT medalist, by the way.
Ah.
Proud of that one. Nobody teaches you this. So Scott had the experience to kind of enlighten me and give me this vision. You know, like, how are we going to do this? I take everything I've known in the golf industry from little companies like, you know, Toski Golf or Triumph Golf or Magique, or these component companies to kind of semi, you know, companies like Tommy Armor Irons that got a little bigger, but, you know, didn't hit full, you know, TaylorMade, Callaway, Ping. And then we got little, you know, odd companies throughout history. And I just really had to sit back and look, you know, okay, well, where's the putter companies at? What, who did what, how'd they do it? And I would be calling. This is how desperate I was. This is how little information there is. Remember, I'm a golf pro, right? I'm not.
Yeah.
I was so brazen. I called the owner of Lampkin and asked him if he could tell me what kind of rubber to use. He said, go figure it out, essentially.
That's great. Yeah, I remember that Dave Peltz putter with the three balls behind it. I'm like, wow, this is perfect for me.
Yeah, and they made those non-conforming because banned those were too. Appendages.
And then,
you know, but hey, listen, he got $2 or $3 a putter off of every two-ball putter for I don't know how many years.
Yeah.
Dave, you mentioned, knocked it out of park.
You mentioned Lucas Glover, you know, playing a big part, his two consecutive wins, in giving you a different level of exposure. How important is it for you guys or for any company that comes up with a revolutionary product? And I mean, I remember when the Ping putters came out, they took a lot of heat as well. You know, nobody, you know, and look at them now. How important?
Well, they didn't pay forever.
Right.
Remember that?
Yeah. How important is it for you to have players using this, people who play for money, who play tournament golf for money, using these things on the TV? And how many players do you have now, and how do you make those relationships?
Well, as a real small company, you actually don't want it. You can crash your company that fast. But as you start to get to the, you know, kind of the, what you call a boutique size, which is still super small, a little exposure on the medium tours is what you got to do. If you just come out, and all your first year in business and somebody wins, what are you going to do? You don't have the machines. Yeah,
You can't
have your whole website will crash.
Yeah.
You don't have the 100 grand to put into a website. That's what a website costs. It's just so having it in doses. If you have success in doses, you can get big. If there's anything besides that, you're lucky if you've got even the mid-size. So, because to grow, you need capital. And if you're just wholesaling and paying reps, you're not making any money. So you have to have the capital to grow. And then you have to have a little success as your platform and the ability. My first month in business, I could get 10 putters a day with two people. That was a good day, and that's from shafting, cutting the shaft, balancing, shipping, packaging, just
everything.
All of it. Got to wait for the epoxy to dry, We're so poor, you don't even pre-glue heads together because you don't want to ruin one for an order you don't have.
But what you just said, that snack-sized growing, I'll call it, is exactly why surviving the first 3 years in business is so important. That's how you do it.
Exactly. And honestly, I thought, the product was so good, I would be, somewhere on an island in Hawaii, but within 3 years. That's how good I thought it was. That's how disillusioned I was with business.
Yeah.
But you know what? Sometimes dumb is the best way to go.
Exactly. How many guys are playing your putter now on tour? I mean, the big ones, of course, that we always see is Adam Scott. Now we have Richard Bland. We had Sergio, I think. No?
Ben Ahn, Will Zalatoris.
Yeah, Zalatoris, exactly. Yeah.
There's a bunch of slash. We had a dozen in the last major. And then we had this at this last Masters.
Yeah.
There's a great stat for you.
Yeah.
We had 14% of the field on Saturday and Sunday.
Yep. I read that stat. That was that's gotta give you goosebumps. It gives me goosebumps.
pretty wild. I don't know how to.
But do these guys come to you and say, hey, we heard you got a great product? Or do you send somebody out there and say, look at this? I mean,
many of these players are walking billboards. When you start paying players, you sign your soul away.
Yeah.
And you sign their freedom away and you sign your freedom away. And it makes it really hard to get an ROI. And when somebody doesn't get an ROI, then feelings get hurt. And then relationships break down, and then somebody's got to make more money and blah, 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 blah. And so would we engage at a business level with a player? Absolutely. Would it be a pay to play kind of deal? That's not our business model. We're pretty resolute on giving the players as much player support as they want. Every tour we have a tour rep at every event, LIV, LPGA, Champions Tour, PGA Tour, and Korn Ferry, and some Asian, the Asian Tour, and I believe a DP rep now. So it's just staggering, just what it's all becoming. It's just kind of overwhelming.
So you got a product that nobody else can copy because of your patent, and you're not paying players to use it. Who else is do you know any other equipment company that's doing this? I mean, besides the patent, but do you know any other company, you know, from the big boys that would even think about not paying people to play their equipment?
Yeah, I just don't, you know, honestly, I don't. I mean, there might be some wedges out there. I know,
yeah,
I know Tour Edge has, I think, you know, they pay if you win,
yeah,
or something, or you get a top finish or something. But I'm sure that, you know, they've got TV commercials and stuff. And,
yeah.
But again, you know, in this world, in this, the way the marketing in the world is gathering information and making purchases, I think that we have been able to adapt like a ninja. Compared to the large companies, and with our technology,
it reminds me of that economic strategy of blue ocean strategy. That's what it reminds me of. You know, you're not going into the pond with a big fish. You're building your own pond. And
it's almost like Top Golf, where they just built their own audience. You know,
instead of a red ocean. What is the future? One question I asked Sam, and I didn't, to be honest, I didn't really understand the answer because he got taken. Is it possible to make lie angle balanced golf clubs, not just putters?
Yeah,
it is. Is that coming?
Yeah. No, it's totally non-conforming.
Oh, it's totally non-conforming. Yeah, but I'm sure you build yourself a club just to have fun and go out and play some. Are you going to show me?
Well, there were some cool ones back in the day. Remember, like the Fila irons that had the shank-proof neck behind the face? It was almost like a flipped-over Cleveland VAS.
Oh, okay. I remember the VASs.
Yeah. But, you know, it gets a little sketchy when you go into it. The reality is, when you go into CG location and you go into clubs with less loft and let's say an 8-iron or so, maybe a 7-iron, people are going to shank it and break the shaft tips because they'll go under the club, pop it up, you know, in the rough. And and quite honestly, if you hit a ball with a shaft going 80 miles an hour, it really hurts your hands. That would be where I could say, listen, as we get into some shorter lofts or shorter, more lofted golf clubs, I would start moving the shaft towards the heel. And then, you know, as a driver, it could be down near dead center if you want.
Right.
But there's a friend, while I got you and we're doing this, I'll give a shout out to a guy. His name is John Hayes. He's on my Facebook, and Persimmon Club Builder, and just fabulous. Club builder, and he has found an old Fitch that he's turning, and it's going to be pretty much a lab persimmon driver.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, I can't make titanium; it's all non-conforming to do that stuff. And until the USGA changes their rules, you'll never see a lab iron or driver.
There you go. How much hands-on are you these days, Bill? I mean, I see you on a kayak or whatever, you canoeing, whatever you do there. You build your own Hobie Cat. I don't even know what that is. How much hands-on are you in the daily operations of lab these days?
Zero.
Zero.
Not hands-on at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I watch and see what's going on, and I think the, you know, a company is streamlined now. So you get these people making a living, you know, doing jobs, and so that means I don't do a job.
Yeah, there you go. You're not a micromanager. That's good to know. This weekend I saw that Jay Haas also was playing the lab at the senior U.S. Senior Open with his old buddy and his old caddy from way back, Bill Harmon, on his bag, and I believe he shot under par for all four rounds, which is incredible for a 70. He broke his age, he broke his age.
Yeah, broke his age, huh?
Twice, yeah. And Bill said that it was incredible putting performance. He wrote in a message, and Bill is a guy. He's been on the show a few times, and he always talks about the Harmon family and everything. He talks a lot about his sobriety as well. How much do you attribute the success? I don't know, the gratification of having done this to your sobriety?
Well, the success, ironically, had nothing to do with my sobriety, but the success also happened in conjunction with my sobriety. Does that say something, like, you know, that there's nothing bigger, something bigger out there?
Yeah, and you're enjoying
it. But that crosses my mind, you know, in a real way. I just wonder. I've seen Bill Harmon on Facebook, and I sent him a friend request years ago, but I don't think he's on my friend or my Facebook. So I wasn't aware.
There you go. Well, now that you've been on the show, you're officially a Golf Show all-star. And so is Bill. We got a super secret group on Facebook where we.
Okay, cool.
People's back. No, we don't.
So I'm, you know, when we first formed Lab, and we had Vaughn Taylor playing the putter early. We also had Bill Haas for several events.
Okay.
So I knew way, way back when, this is probably 5 years ago now, that Jay had, you know, was aware
that there was something like this out there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Bill's rolling, right? He's like, oh, if it feels good, you know, just don't watch your swing. You know, they're not swing lookers, right? And so, and I don't know what happened, but we lost him. But I knew then, you know, that Jay had seen it. And I was always thinking, oh, man, it'd be so cool if Jay played the player.
And then without you, you didn't know when you saw it on the TV?
No, I didn't. I had no idea that he
how
had
cool
one
is that?
On TV. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And I didn't, I can't see Bill Harmon's post or socials. Yeah, yeah. Didn't even know he was caddying. Because I know his Claude coaches Jimmy Walker and some of the other players out there has been a very nice spokesperson to his players and having them try Lab over the years. So I know that there's awareness between Lab and the Harmon group family. But I've never met Bill. I've met Claude a few times. Great guy.
Yeah. Yeah, they're good people. I mean, I just know Bill from the show, but great.
That's awesome. It must have been special to, you know, I remember, you know, he reminds me when he's playing of Jeff Maggart. It's just a machine. You could put those two on a driving range. I don't know if you could tell them apart. And I remember Jeff Maggart used to go down and hit range balls at this rinky dink little driving range in Scottsdale in the Indian Ben Wash. It was called Coronado Driving Range. I mean, it is the bottom of the bucket as far as driving ranges go in Arizona.
Yeah.
But they had decent range balls, and it was, nobody was there. But I live so close, I would go there at night in the evening to hit some balls because they had lights and it was the only one that was lit. And Maggart would go out there and pound balls like, you know, three or four times a week, it seemed like. So I'd see this guy and he'd be 20 feet from me and I'd just watch his ball. His ball, you could have put these down a tube, like a big 12 inch tube. Going out, I mean, this ball just every single time, and the same finish. And Jay his swing is just like that in the way he plays golf. And I think that's why, you know, it's an efficient swing. There's no slack. There's no magic move. It needs a ton of maintenance to time right. Yeah. You know, it's a timeless swing, as I like to call them. You don't need a lot of timing because mechanically stuff's in line. And so, it was really cool to see the, you know, Jay and then have Richard win it. I just like, wow, yeah. I was blown away.
Yeah, well, Bill wrote that Jay had an above average putting week. So,
well, that's fantastic. That is awesome.
What else did I want to talk to you? Oh, I wanted to tell you the story about Scotty Cameron. Because there's word on the street that there's some copies of the lab or the lab design or something coming out. A good friend of mine told me that way back when Scotty first came out, his nickname in the industry was Xerox. And he sued, he went to court somewhere so people couldn't call him Xerox anymore. Pretty funny.
Did he win?
I think so. But the guy told me the story, and it's on one of the shows he told me. But I remember what you
posted. I mean, you make your bed.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this is a really important part about ethics. And I think, especially in the putter business, you're so low in ethics in order to make a buck. It's disconcerting. I guess it's now that I'm in where I'm at in the putter world, I see things a little differently than I did when I first got in.
Yeah.
I've been imitated by Gear and Rife.
Mm-hmm.
And Scotty now, as far as I know, not perfectly lab balanced, but they're certainly targeting the players that we have with his broomsticks that just got released. And nobody knows if they're perfectly balanced, or maybe Sam does. I don't know. I don't really worry about it. As far as I'm concerned, they're just fueling the fire.
Yeah.
I mean, when they're just validating everything that I've done to try to, and there's nothing, we can putt with a pitching wedge. We can putt with some resistance in our putter. People, you know, get a groove. It's like irons and drivers. Do I think that we shouldn't? Yes, absolutely. Can you? Absolutely. So are they going to sell face balance? Sure. Are they going to sell toe hang? Sure. Because that's just what some people want, right? Yeah. You sell them what they want. And if they don't want lab, then you're going to sell the other ones.
Exactly.
And so,
exactly. We certainly don't have to sell labs here because everybody knows what it is. You know, the different models, they can all see on your site. And,
thank you.
I don't think we even have to tell them what the site is. They can find out for themselves. But it's Lab Putters.
Yeah.
Is it Lab.com? Something like lab.com. If people could spend $600-$800 on a driver that they use maybe 4, 5, 6 times around, why not spend a little less than that on a club you use 30 times around? I mean, that's
you know, yeah. This is the God's honest truth. If people would go buy one of two putters, a directed force black head with a standard alignment, a steel shaft, and a 3-degree grip at 70 degrees and 34 inches long, and figure it out.
Yeah.
They'd be great, right?
Yeah.
They'd make, just save them a ton of putts.
Yeah. See, I
like because that. if you're not those specs and you're a standard size man, there's something wrong with your posture, or I shouldn't say that. There's something weird going on, right? Now, we can have different grips that are more upright, more flat, but typically you're going to find all the great putters pretty much in the same spot when they start. And or the Mez standard size putter in a steel shaft with a 2-degree pistol grip is a home run. if somebody wants something smaller than the DF that Bland was using,
yeah,
to get a standard size Mez steel shaft with a 2-degree grip stock 69 or 71 or whatever we offer, get it in the ballpark and learn how to use it. I created remote fitting and I've been a master fitter, right? But there's some things in life that I've just learned through experience and trial and error that I feel it's safe to say, and that's one of them.
Yeah.
You know, like if you need to be custom fit, absolutely, you know, and yeah, you should always be custom fit. But if you go through our free remote fitting and you're pretty standard,
Figure it out how to use it. I mean, that's how I learned golf. I mean, I got, you know, I had like a fucking set of Wilson staff blades with an S300 shaft. I'd never played golf before, and I learned how to use them, you know.
Anyways. So that's what we, you know, I really think. And if the short putters, if you're still shaking, you know, and you're all over the place with a short putter, then get a broomstick and lean over. And if you don't look exactly like Adam Scott or Ben Ahn or Lucas or Will Zalatoris, or Glover, you're not leaned over enough and you're using the old broomstick method, which will not be effective as the modern broomstick with much more lean over, shorter, and the left elbow out.
What, wrapping it up, what is your relationship, not relationship, not maybe the right word. What's the deal with Bryson? I mean, he would be the perfect candidate for your putters, wouldn't he? The scientist himself? I mean, the guy who...
Yeah. I mean, we had him when he turned pro.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he was fresh off of that amateur career that was off the charts. And then I fitted him and made him an arm lock putter, which was back before, you know, arm locking was, a thing. And he played, I don't know how many events, a dozen events or half a dozen events.
He played the amateur. He played the Masters as an amateur. It was his best performance,
yeah,
at the Masters, right?
Yeah. And so he was using the Directed Force 2.1 or Reno. And then he got his contracts with other companies and, you know, because he had just turned pro.
Yeah.
And so Hobart came in and then Puma, you know, they just everything, and I lost him. And there's a story that I did on the Fire Pit Collective with Matt Janella about it, but I'll give you the nuts is, you know, I was having lunch with McCord, Gary McCord at Whisper Rock, and he leans over and he says, "Hey, check this out. Bryson's messaging me and it's a video of Bryson to me asking if I could make a putter, one of my DFs that he had, that didn't have the forward lean so that he could do this.
The forward lean himself.
Non-conforming stroke side saddle thing that he did with the beer can. You know, that beer can putter, that half beer can putter. And so I reluctantly, and it really tore it. I lost sleep over it. I was terrified, but I said, no,
right.
I can't do that. I don't think that's a conforming stroke. And if I made my putter balanced in that position at 80 degrees with no forward lean and you putted well with it, they could make the putter non-conforming because it's effective in a non-conforming fashion.
Yeah.
That's in the USGA. They have, when you get into club building and club making and submitting stuff, you read all this stuff and it's clear as day. And I lost him. That's why I lost.
Yeah.
I couldn't make that.
The purist did you.
Yeah. And that sucked. I mean, excuse me, but that was a
bit.
Yeah. That was tough to say no.
Sure.
However, you know, Bryson's well aware of lab.
Yeah.
And so,
absolutely,
it's okay.
He knows where you live.
Someday, we hope someday.
There you go.
We'll see him rolling.
Well,
something
I mean,
just, is not a plumber's neck, you know, torquey type putter. But, you know, he puts it so well. And because he's got the flat side locked against his arm, which is like my original tricep putter, right, the billboard, that's literally what I was doing.
Yeah. Look at Rory pulling a Doug Sanders, Phil Mickelson at the Open with those two putts.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, the yeah. first thing that came to my mind, and I'm not making it up, it's, would that have happened with the lab putter? You know, yeah. I mean, because one, I don't know, the last one, there was like a dent in the way, but
yeah,
you know, those guys, for them, it all comes down to this. Final question or final topic. The word on the street is you might write a book. What's the
title? Yeah. Yeah,
and what's
I'm
it?
I'm waiting for the book deals to come rolling in.
I bet you got a bunch of great stories to tell.
I do. I've had quite a life, actually. It's pretty wild.
Well,
yeah. I mean, it's crossed my mind quite a bit, especially, you know, on social. I have people suggest I should write a book.
There you go.
And I read it here and there, and it just gets me thinking.
Well, you're going to have to come back and talk to us about that. And you're,
if I get back from my next adventure, maybe I'll write a book.
You're not really living in like a big mansion, are you?
No. I sold my house. My daughter has her own family now, and I have a 3.5-year-old grandson.
Congratulations. From grandpa to grandpa.
3.5 years ago, Super Bowl, we're coming up. Super Bowl will be 4 years. I quit drinking, and I just got rid of everything in my life, including my other half. And once she was gone, and I went on a crusade to become fit and sober, and so that in case my inventions did do well, that I could live for years to enjoy the financial rewards of taking such risks and working so hard to get to where you're at, that you know, health and happiness and mindset and being grounded in reality and Mother Nature and your family, and it's just, there's no substitute. And in the business world, it's so easy to lose track of what's important or be somebody that you aren't,
right?
Which I see people lost to. I see people, they don't even know who they are. They're being somebody that they want everybody else to think they should be, or they're trying to present. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So genuine, you know, authentic would be and honest. I'm brutally honest, and even my own worst critic. I mean, I've always had to pay for my consequences, so I became extremely honest, right? And so I try to hold other people accountable for their honesty. Right. And on social, you know, if somebody says something mean or bad or what I perceive as just what an asshole, I call them out, and I'm not afraid to do it. Yeah. But it's daunting because, you know, in the golf industry, I'm certainly a little more known now than I was. And, that can reflect on the company, even though I'm not day to day, I'm a co-owner. And so I've been asked to stifle it now and then, for reasons of people watch and, you know, and you shouldn't do this. And, you know, this is all stuff that will go in a book someday.
I can't wait for that. And, you know, this is one of the things we've tried to do from the beginning, is to provide a platform for, interesting people. I'll just call them interesting people, you know, and to speak freely and honestly without, you know, we don't want to have these plastic interviews that you see on TV with the big TV channels. Yeah. So, I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks.
I appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate you being so open and honest, and and sharing your wisdom and your knowledge for free. Thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity. I know we've been trying to get this together. I'm a little fleeting at times.
You fleet away, my friend. You go on a little trip. You enjoy that.
Well, thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Come back safe and give my best to Sam.
Will do.
All right. To the Linksland, ladies and gentlemen.